This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to the show at 6 a.m. 17th April. And you're with Julian Ng, Lin Mark, and Wang Xiaoning. Good morning, ladies. How are you guys?
Not too bad, Julian.
Good morning.
And we have some interesting discussions coming up over the course of the next hour, some very interesting stories.
Yes, so we're going to be talking a little bit about language. Now, we are familiar with it, of course we are, because it is our primary means of communication.
Yes.
But it can also be extremely coded. So choice of adjectives, for example, can mean a lot more than even we think, because sometimes we aren't aware of our own prejudices. So that's something that we're going to be discussing a little more later on.
And do you love your online shopping?
I do.
You do? Mm-hmm. But you're always missing your packages because you aren't at home?
I do that too.
Well, don't worry. It's not a problem anymore.
Yay. Okay. That's what I call advancement in technology. Okay, coming up next, we will have this story about the merits of this order. And in the meantime, here's Princess of the Universe by Queen, BFM 89.9. PFM 89.9, 6:07 in the morning, Breaking the Law by Judas Priest. You're with The Morning Run, Julian Lin and Wang Xiaoning here with you. Now, we have a story from Aeon about the defense of disorder, very well written and somewhat artistic, I must say. And it says that human beings have a conflicted relationship with this order-disorder nexus. And earlier on in the year, we were all wrapped up in this Marie Kondo movement earlier this year. And this article is somewhat anti-Kondo. So sometimes disorder brings you joy.
But wasn't the Marie Kondo movement kind of about like tidiness?
Yes.
Rather than, because I think one of the things that they raise here in this order disorder nexus is that it's not so much not just maybe untidiness or spontaneity. It can also be just enjoying, like human beings enjoying an asymmetrical aesthetic as well, because it's not perfectly in sync. That apparently speaks something to our inner love for disorder.
I guess that's one way to look at it. But coming from a person who's really, really disorderly, you know, I interpret it as, you know, like
validation of your disorderliness.
Absolutely, thank you.
So now you feel normal, right, Julian?
I do feel normal.
Okay,
yeah, I find a lot of order in my disorder. I know where my things are. And even when someone else tidies up my place for me, you know, then my mind gets disorderly. And that's one of the paradoxes of my life, actually.
I don't know. I'm the opposite of you, Julian. I like everything where it should be. I'm pretty obsessed, I would say.
Well, my stuff is where they are. It's just untidy.
But only for you.
Yes.
Only you understand that order, right? I'm the opposite. Everything has to be put in its place. If you look at the cupboard, you know, okay, white shirts here, blue shirts here, green shirts here. It's just, otherwise it drives me nuts.
So you have been Marie Kondoing your life even before the book came out?
Yes, yes. I do love Marie.
See, you would have gotten very rich if only you wrote down all your experiences.
And had a Netflix series all of your
exactly.
own.
Yeah, and looked as cute as her, but no, I'm not, unfortunately.
Oh, you're quite cute. Okay, never mind. On to the next subject.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think I fall kind of more on the side of you, Julian, because I'm the same. Like, I have, my bookshelf, for example, is extremely disorderly, but I kind of know where everything is, and it used to be when someone would come into my room and take a book to go and read, I would walk in and the first thing I would notice is that there was a book out of place. But then like my parents would be, how did you even notice? Your bookshelf is a mess. And I'm like, no, but I know. I know because there is some kind of a sense of order there, even if it's only apparent to me. Yeah, I don't know. But otherwise, I think I do, aside from the disorderliness of my general life, in terms of the things that I enjoy, like I enjoy, for example, geometric patterns, so very orderly sort of aesthetics. But I don't know. I can also see the attraction in things like, have you seen Japanese flower arrangements, ikebana?
I've heard of it, and I haven't got to that level where I'm appreciating it. But I'm actually thinking of getting into bonsai because I just like snipping things away. You know? Anyway, okay. What about Ikebana?
Okay, do you need any scissors? Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a dangerous combination. Okay, no, but I guess bonsais are the same as well because, you know, you are introducing that level of asymmetry and I guess disorder, but in an orderly context. Because, for example, if you look at Ikebana, most of Japanese flower arrangements do have that element of asymmetry because it's visual interest. But if you look at the rest of the Japanese culture, typically it is extremely orderly. So I guess maybe this flower arrangement and the traditions that have come up around it are reflective of this need for disorder in some element of their lives because otherwise they are an extremely orderly sort of people.
Yeah, I also know about this Japanese pottery art, which is all about not imperfection, right?
You
sort of sculpt something, but not to a perfect extent. And it's very beautiful. It turns out to be very beautiful and very different from the kind of perfectly sculpted pieces that you see from other parts of the world. And it's a huge movement in Japan.
Which brings back to the question that aren't we all contradictory in some way? In that we like order in some way, but then we also like disorders in other ways.
Okay, which brings me the question, is it all in your mind? And what is it? Is it just the aesthetics, which is a mind thing, right? You feel the orderly or disorderliness. Or is it about efficiency? What is it, right? Are these problems that we have created in our minds?
Efficiency. Why would it be about efficiency?
Because if things are orderly, you know, okay. like in my kitchen, right? The kitchen is one place where I like things to be orderly. I need to know where things are and they need to be there and not somewhere else. And this is very different from my study, right? So the kitchen is about efficiency and the study is somewhat about something else.
Creativity.
I don't know. I don't know. Creativity would be a nice way to put it.
Yeah. I thought the interesting thing, the question that this article from Aeon raised in me is that, it's the nature versus nurture argument, right? Because this seems to put forward that we are naturally inclined towards this appreciation of disorder. Or is it just something in our upbringing that, you know, maybe we are put into this kind of orderly sort of orderly environments all the time. We are taught to stay within the rules, operate within a certain system that a part of us that wants to rebel suddenly starts to appreciate a slightly more disorderly system.
I don't know. Maybe it's the left brain, right brain argument.
Could be.
Right?
Could be, yep. Mm-hmm. And also, I think the world, the natural world itself, is not a Marie Kondo kind of place. It's pretty disorderly, right, when you go out there into the wild.
I'd like to see someone try and Kondo a jungle.
Yes. All right, so if you want to join in the conversation, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'd love to hear from you. And coming up next, how we use words, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Earth Within Fire with September. You're with The Morning Run, Julian Lin and Xiaoning here with you. Now, we have an article from The Guardian. Now, firstly, a question. What colour is in your mind when we say skin colour? So for half of the world, this refers to a ferritone, and that may be problematic because it leads to labelling. So the story from The Guardian entitled "A Smooth, Angry, Cool, Powerful, How We Talk About Blackness" is about words we use. And some of these words that are used possibly in America to describe the black people, it's kind of problematic. And I was wondering whether we can learn lessons from here about local sensitivities.
It's quite an interesting article, actually, because it's not just, it doesn't just deal with some of the more obvious terms that you would think of when talking about blackness. It talks about, it addresses things like, for example, they give an example of the Williams sisters, you know, Serena and Venus Williams in tennis. And the words used to describe them by commentators are typically along the lines of powerful, you know, very strong, very bold. And this author, who's written quite a few books about blackness and black culture, he finds this slightly, he finds this slightly odd because he feels like it plays into the stereotypes of black women as almost intimidating figures in their strength, right? So it, he feels that it implies that their success in tennis is due to some kind of raw innate strength rather than years and years of practice and skill. And I think that it is something that we see very much with women here. I mean, all over the world, but also here. Like, for example, when you look at female candidates who go for political positions, how the media defines them, how even we in conversation sometimes talk about them, it can show almost like an innate prejudice that we don't even realize. Yep. It's like when you see a woman on TV and she's talking, you say, and the first thing you say is, oh yeah, she's quite pretty. Why do we say that? Mm-hmm. Because are we saying that her main attribute is that she's pretty? No, she's running for politics because she has something she wants to do, because obviously she's a smart, ambitious person. But the first comment that most people have is that, she looks nice. Yeah. It's that obsession with a women's look. So it's
innate prejudice that we have within us. Also, reminds me of this classic story of Asians in England studying in Australia or the US and getting comments, oh, your English is so good, right? It's something like that. Your English is surprisingly good because you're Asian, not because you have learned that language and speak that language quite proficiently.
Or that you live in houses.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's an old one.
No, actually, one of my friends did get asked this. And, you know, I went to university not really that long ago. And a friend of mine was from Sarawak. But, you know, the English people sometimes don't know where that is. And he did get asked, in all honesty, so do you live in houses?
Or on trees?
Or do you still live in trees? And he was like, are you serious?
That's terrible. I mean, in this day and age, also reminds me of that discussion we had about that woman, again from The Guardian, an article in The Guardian talking about the discovery of Nangka, right?
Oh,
or,
yes.
Or the jackfruit.
Oh, yeah.
That caused a lot of consternation in half of the world. But I'm just wondering, in the local context, whether... I think this article is very, I would say, advanced because it really comes out very honestly in exploring the language that's being used. Locally, we seem to be stepping on eggshells, aren't we? We haven't explored these issues openly and honestly enough. I think that there are a lot of things that we are afraid to talk about ourselves, you know. And I was speaking to Kwa Jen Han recently on The Breakfast Grill. I think we have not come to a point where we have learned to laugh at ourselves, which is a reflection of the kind of honesty and openness that we can have with each other.
Yeah, we're not comfortable yet, I think, with describing ourselves and unpicking what the meaning of these words mean to us, right? As like, let's say I'm Chinese, and then you have all these connotations about Chinese being, you know, money-minded, but then we don't laugh about it. We start to crack jokes about it, but we never really discuss it. I think it's all very sensitive.
Yeah, I think as a community, but then it makes me think that how many communities are able to talk, have that honest conversation about race. I mean, certainly you can't do it in the US because there are so many pitfalls that you can fall into. So I think that's something that definitely going forward we all need to think a little bit more about, I guess.
Okay, if you're interested to get the book, it's written by Jeffrey Bokai, and it's titled Blacklisted, Black British Culture Explored. So he's British. And you can get this article from our tweet as well. We're going into the news right now, and here's Everyday People by Sly and the Family Stone, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. You're with Julian Lin and Xiao Ning. And that was AC/DC with You Shook Me All Night Long. And we have a story here, a local story. 86 LRT stations are offering lockers to pick up your deliveries. This seems to me a conflation of our life's biggest needs, commute and shopping.
Do you shop a lot, Julian? Do you think you'll use this kind of service?
If I were to give a quick answer, I would say no. I don't really spend a lot of time shopping.
or going to train stations? Which is it?
I go a lot to train stations, actually. I use the MRT quite a lot.
Okay, but you just don't do online shopping?
I do, but not a lot. I wouldn't be classified as one of those people who constantly shop for stuff.
I don't actually shop online that much either, but I was just thinking, right, because here in BFM, our news team particularly is very famous for forever getting packages. I think there's at least two packages a week for someone from the news team, and they get sent to our office, and our office admin jokes that she should start charging a logistics fee for processing all of these parcels. So I think that, hey, you know, this could be something that we could float to our news team for them to use, and if there's one at the Bandar Utama MRT station, so much the better.
Yeah, but it's like super convenient, right? I mean, it's like a seamless thing. You go home, on the way home, you pick up your packages. It's perfect. I think this is an excellent idea.
I think so, except for the fact that it's located in the LRT station. So you would have to be using the LRT station to benefit from this. And I don't. I use mostly the MRT because there is no LRT station nearby. But I think for a lot of people, this is very useful. And going back to like shopping online, right? I think it's harder and harder to resist it because all kinds of business models are coming onto the market to lure you into shopping online. For example, GrabFood, right? Right now, it used to be when I was hungry and if there was nothing to eat at home, then you would just have to resist it, right?
Or eat Maggie Mee.
Eat nothing, right? I mean, I don't buy instant noodles. But today, the world is open to you. And then how about shopping, right? Simple things like at least non-perishable goods like pet food and your cleaners, detergents, and so on. It's so easy to buy them online right now because of all these delivery services. And when the delivery guy comes to the doorstep and you're not at home, and that's an inconvenience.
Yeah, I think so.
But I don't think these locker things apply so much to your like household items. It's more your clothes, because how big can these lockers be, right? In some way.
I think it depends. I took a look at the article from the Malay Mail, and they're pretty decently sized. Yeah, I think you could fit quite a lot in them. And while right now they are at LRT stations, there's nothing to say that they couldn't expand to MRT stations, pharmacies, shopping malls. Because I know when I was in the UK, we would see kind of these parcel lockers in places like high traffic malls, places where there were a lot of bus stops, for example. So people who caught the bus to and from work or school could just swing in, pick up their items, and it was relatively easy.
Yeah, they already have this model in Japan, and like Lynn said, it's not just at the train stations. They have it at pharmacies, 7-11, supermarkets, 7-Elevens. So I think in Malaysia, it's probably just a matter of time till these lockers get rolled out to all these type of convenience spots.
Yeah, although just looking at the picture, if this thing really takes off, it does look like there would be not enough boxes. Like it looks like there are a limited number of boxes. But I'm sure that these guys who are behind it, a startup called Ninja Van, they would have to think about all these things in their business model and to just drive and expand their business. But right now, looking at it, it seems like the lockers are quite limited in numbers. And this brings me to the other point, the park and rides, MRT stations and the LRT stations, right? They also run out of parking. I mean, talk about convenience, driving your car to the park and ride and then riding the MRT right into downtown KL. You can't do that now because the parking is all full up.
Which is why we need to really think about the last mile connectivity.
Absolutely. Right. And this is what it is, right? This is last mile connectivity for the delivery. What about environmental concerns? Like, we're buying so much stuff online, packaging. Is it a net positive carbon footprint? What do you guys think? Like, are we causing more damage to the environment from buying stuff online?
I don't know. Isn't there some carbon footprint if we go shopping and we get into our cars?
Yes,
and then
you
drive
save
there?
That, but you break it down to many more spontaneous orders online. And but, then, yeah.
But I mean, if you, with delivery services can also hire fewer people now, and there obviously is going to be a bit of a livelihood element to it as well, but they don't have to spend so much time driving out to different houses located in all the corners of KL. So they would use less petrol, therefore have a smaller carbon footprint. But then, you know, a lot of people will also be out of jobs. So there's kind of a balancing act there that we need to settle.
Okay, we're going for a break now and more discussion after that. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. Julian Lin and Xiao Ning here with you. And that was Hung Upside Down by Buffalo, someone named Buffalo something, Springfield. Buffalo Springfield. And we're talking about emerging business models to capitalize on our increasingly digitalized life. However, we are also being a food-obsessed nation, driving to far-flung places to eat at popular destinations. And this might not be a good thing, according to an article from the Malay Mail, Makan Apa, the curse and blessing of your neighborhood's popularity.
Yes, so it is an opinion editorial, and it's talking about those people who every so often drive from far-flung places to track down this odd local nasi lemak stall, for example. And then there are just more and more of them. And eventually locals start saying, can't you all stop coming here and causing traffic jams in our area?
Do they actually say that? I've not had someone say that to me, but maybe because I'm such a bum. Don't want to go out more than 1 kilometer radius from my home.
I think the other complaint is that, you know, all these non-local people raise the prices of the food at these joints, yeah, right? Because they add to the popularity.
That's a very important lesson in exchange rates and inflation, right? If your nation is cheap enough, the foreigners would come in and push up the prices, and therefore your exchange rate cannot remain low for a long time. Anyway, let's move on for that.
We need to sell a lot more food, Julia.
There might be a lot of loopholes in my economic argument, but so let's not go there.
Yeah, so there are a couple of examples given. Quinoa, for example, because, you know, since the craze for healthy organic food started, it's become a crop too expensive for poor local growers to eat. So I guess it's, you know, you're really seeing the real life impact of demand on these local industries. But there's also just the fact that because we are living in such a digital society, you know, social media is a big driver of this kind of thing. And there've been a couple of articles, for example, dealing with the effects of social media on like local tourist destinations, for example. There was a street in Paris that practically had to shut down because they just saw a huge influx of Instagrammers, people shooting music videos. But this was a regular neighborhood street, and people were trying to just go into their homes and live their lives, and it was being constantly disrupted by this flow of people driven by social media. There have been other cases as well, like so in California, the poppy superbloom that's happening. There are videos of, you know, these beautiful fields of orange flowers, but then just everywhere you see dotted people taking pictures and traffic jams getting into areas, you know, and with people just getting out of their cars just to take pictures and pose amongst the flowers.
Yeah, I think this increasingly globalized world, it's not a good thing for the locals as well. I mean, witness Penang or Malacca, which are UNESCO status heritage sites. And I think while the tourism is bringing in the dollars, it's really destroyed what is left of the heritage, right? I mean, the tourists, the graffiti on the walls, like artistic graffiti, so-called, you know, the look and feel of the original place is gone. But I guess some would call that progress. It's unavoidable.
Yeah, but how do you find that balance, you know? Because you all these businesses do need to survive. They do need to make more money, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you just rely on the local customers, is that enough?
Yeah, true. That's a good question.
True also. But maybe it's just that we, as countries and, you know, as government legislators also, we just don't know yet how to deal with the very quickly developing digital landscape. It's like how we are starting to figure out how to implement digital taxes. We don't know how to deal with this influx of tourists caused by social media yet.
Okay, we're coming up to the 7 a.m. news, and after that, an update of the international markets, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.